Hello and welcome to the Mixed Media Podcast for Wednesday, February 23rd. I'm Chris Wagner, culture critic for the Dallas Morning News. I'm joined in the studio, as always, by Christopher Wynn, the arts and culture editor for the Dallas Morning News. Hello, Christopher.
Hello, Chris Wagner. It's strange hearing new titles and
what
new things.
What a great title that is, too.
It's a brave new world. That was Lauren Smart. She is the arts and culture editor for the Dallas Observer still. Hello.
Welcome to the club, Christopher.
That's a lot of culture, fiends in one room.
It's a culture club. On today's show, as we approach Oscar So White Sunday, Dallas Morning News interactive editor Dana Amihir has studied the last 20 years of Oscar's acting data. She joins us to discuss the results. Next, Marsha, a much-discussed New York Magazine article, declares that Marsha Clark is redeemed. With a push from the People vs. O.J. Simpson miniseries, is the 90s boogie woman set to become a feminist icon? Finally, how can literature shape and define a city? We'll discuss the takeaways from the panel Lauren Smart. Let's say that again. The panel Lauren Smart moderated this weekend at the 2016 Dallas Festival of Ideas. But first, it says on our run sheet that we're supposed to discuss Christopher Wynn's nervous breakdown.
I know, yeah.
It doesn't say that specifically.
There's a lot going on, so I'm in my new role as arts and culture editor at the Morning News, which means that I have Slack going on my phone in my lap. Deadlines are flying. Things are happening as I'm going from that monthly magazine rhythm that I'm so used to the daily rhythm of a daily newspaper, which, wow. It's a whole different ballgame.
So you have been thrown into a new job, and you are doing it and learning it as the days go.
Yes, I'm head fry cook now. it's been fun. It's been interesting. The hardest part has been that daily pace, that different rhythm that I'm not used to. But I'm learning that's also the best part because it means I can get in a lot more stories and cover things in a way that I couldn't in that sort of monthly cycle where everything was 2 and 3 months out. And so that part's been really fun. So,
will you still be reporting stories as well, or are you fully editor?
I'm still going to write.
In your copious free time.
When I can.
Right.
I noticed your new editor at The Observer, of course, has already had, you know, 2 cover stories, I think. So
it's
making
us
all look bad. but I will still be doing that. And in my new role, I have all the critics, including Chris Wagner, who I'm very excited to continue working with. And Mark Lamster and Leslie Brenner, and you know, so it's a whole new world, but it's been a lot of fun.
We all have enormous egos, just so you know.
Oh, I'm ready for that.
Have fun with that.
Yeah. Good luck.
Well, it's good to see you up and about and sentient and coherent.
That remains to be seen. Yeah,
we'll see how we're doing in 40 minutes.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's get started. For the second year in a row, the slate of Academy Award nominees in the 4 major acting categories don't include a single person of color. Dallas Morning News interactive editor Dana Amihir has studied the last 20 years of Oscar data and found that the nominations are sorely lacking minority representation. Welcome, Dana.
Hello. Great to be here.
So what's the skinny? What did you discover? What are some of the more troubling stats that you can give us?
Well, it wasn't so much that it was a surprise that there were so few minorities. It was more troubling to find that the roles that they were in are a lot more menial or indigent or involve violence, involve some sort of abuse, as opposed to their white counterparts.
I was wondering, could you describe kind of your methodology? Like, how did you put this together?
Sure. I went through the Academy's Academy Award database and painstakingly transcribed 20 years of data into a spreadsheet.
Welcome to the Morning News.
Good times.
Yes, good times. And as I was transcribing everything, I noticed that the same names kept appearing over and over and over, and they were disproportionately white. Aside from that, I remembered a lot of these movies, having mm-hmm. seen them and seen depictions of, you know, Denzel Washington in Training Day as a corrupt cop, or Viola Davis in The Help as a housekeeper, mm-hmm. Octavia Spencer in the same movie. And then as I moved a little bit further back in Oscar's history, I noticed that two things. that there were more minorities actually winning and being nominated in the 70s and 80s, which was really, really surprising, considering the focus that I had on the past 20 years of data. And also the roles were a lot more varied further back in history.
So it's really as much a question of quality as quantity, it sounds like, and the kinds of – it sounds like it's very hard to, for instance, get nominated just playing a regular person of color.
Yes.
It was not a pimp or a corrupt cop or
– I wasn't seeing any business CEOs, lawyers, you know, regular people.
So, Dana, one of the things that stuck out to me is that only one black woman has ever won for Best Actress, and that was Halle Berry. And to your point, it was for that role she played in Monster's Ball as a struggling waitress who ends up sleeping with the corrections officer who helped oversee her husband's execution.
Yes, I found that a lot of the roles, especially the women were playing, were especially depraved or involved just a level of negative attention that was just astounding.
You've written, the roles that these black actors and actresses are recognized for are frequently typecast characters embroiled in negative situations such as criminal activity, slavery, violence, and abuse. In 87 years, only 14 minority actors and actresses have won an Oscar for Best Acting. Technically, it is 15 since Denzel Washington scored Golden Statues for both Glory and Training Day. Why don't we listen to a little bit of Denzel Washington's Oscar-winning performance as a really scary, corrupt cop in Training Day.
I like that. Hey, I like the way you moved out there. You were trained very well. Check that out. It's a dime. See the small hairs, undeveloped seeds, all the stems in it. You see how immature it is? That's classic brick-packed Mexican. That's garbage. Let me see. Give me. Yeah, it's old, too. It's probably from last year. To be truly effective, a good narcotics agent must know and love narcotics. In fact, a good narcotics agent should have narcotics in his blood.
What are you going to smoke that?
Nope, you are.
That is a great performance. I remember watching Training Day the first time, and I just could not take my eyes off of Denzel Washington. I was like, wow, he is really
absolutely
killing this.
One of the things that I want to note is that while the roles that black actors and minority actors are getting are less than desirable characters in most cases, the performances are stellar in almost every case that I can think of.
Has anyone, you or anyone else, done a sort of statistical analysis of how few people of color are writing movies?
That is not something that I got into very much, but I can imagine that the number is also incredibly small.
Yeah.
Considering other awards for the Oscars, like Best Director, Cinematography, those are also lacking minorities. I mean, it's just only recently that we've had a second female win Best Director. So we're sorely behind.
Yeah, that's, see, I mean, it seems like the how hard it would be if you don't have people of color writing films, they're not going to write from the right perspectives anyway. And I think that's frustrating.
I think that is really part of the problem, that we don't have people behind the camera and behind the scenes who are people of color.
And really, I mean, I think the problem goes up higher to the people who are greenlighting movies, who are saying, yes, this one will, you know, do well in China and make another $300 million.
Yeah.
I think that the real, you know, the deeply entrenched problems in the boardrooms, and I think it just kind of trickles down from there. And I think we talk about it during Oscar season, but it's a problem that goes on year round, pretty much every year.
And wasn't, I think we've talked about this in the last episode, but wasn't one of the solutions when this came to the forefront for the Academy was to reevaluate how they choose, who's allowed to be in the Academy.
Their membership?
Yeah. They are weeding out members who have been around for a long time and haven't really been active in the industry, and that's a lot of people. Of course, they're upset about it because they want to vote for the Oscars.
Right,
which I say, too bad.
So my question for you, Chris, is do you think that the, for whatever reason, it has caught fire once again this year, and we know the reasons because it's an all-white lineup, but is there something about the outrage that's happening this year and at this moment and the hashtags and the social media response and all of that that you think will move the needle? Are we beginning to see that maybe change?
It's the most that this issue has been discussed in longer than I can remember. It's kind of popped up and been, you know, continued. It gets talked about a little bit, and then the Oscars happen, and then we just get back to business as usual. It's definitely a more prominent in the public consciousness now. I think social media has a lot to do with that, frankly.
Right.
I think this, you know, people joke about the Oscar so white hashtag, but it's huge. It's made a big difference, and I think it's reaching critical mass. Mm-hmm. Whether that's going to make huge changes in the industry within the next few years, I have no idea. It's a pretty deep seated ailment. And I think it's going to take some time to see real change. But there's no question that we're talking about it.
I think it's interesting, too, Dana, that you pointed out that if you look back beyond 20 years, there were roles that were being filled and when people were winning awards in different ways than they are now. And I think we'll talk about this in the next segment, too. But what happened in the 90s?
Right.
Yes.
I mean, what was going on in our consciousness that we could not deal with anything that wasn't heteronormative, patriarchal, white America?
You're totally teasing to the next segment.
Yeah. You are. Yeah, we'll talk. I mean, if nothing else, we didn't have that check and balance of social media and those other voices that are out there saying, hey, wait a minute, that's, you know, calling BS on all of that. But yes, we'll talk about that with Marcia.
Dana, was there anything that really shocked you in the course of your research? Anything that just made your neck snap back and say, good Lord, I had no idea?
What was interesting to me is this project is actually almost coincided with a new study that came out from University of Southern California, and they studied the top roles in the industry and what percentage of those roles were going to minorities. And to me, it wasn't really surprising that there were so few. What's surprising to me is that nobody's really done a real comprehensive look at the past on these awards and even other awards that are given out.
Well, it's time, obviously. It's happening.
Definitely.
You can see Dana's interactive and read more about the Oscars and diversity at dallasnews.com. And, of course, you can watch the Oscars, which Chris Rock should have a lot of fun with, Sunday night. I will be watching for once, not just because I have to, but I actually kind of want to this year. Dana, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Marcia Clark was the lead prosecutor on the 1995 case against O.J. Simpson for the double murder of his former wife, Nicole Brown Simpson, and her friend, Ronald Goldman. From her tightly permed hair to her aggressive manner, Clark seemed to garner more public disparagement than any of the trial's other players. Now, more than 20 years later, the FX miniseries The People vs. O.J. Simpson has inspired a reappraisal of sorts. Christopher, I know you are excited about this segment. You read Rebecca Traister's piece in New York Magazine, which I just read as well, which is very interesting.
Such a great piece. It has caught on with a lot of people. A lot of my friends are talking about it. I don't know why. I don't know if it's that recent phenomenon. We remember it. We remember the trial so well. We remember Marcia Clark. And the piece just hits at that thing that she was so ridiculed and so... you know, she was so despised is probably too strong of a word. But what's happening now with Sarah Paulson's performance of her in the show is that people are kind of reevaluating their perception of Marcia Clark and realizing kind of what sexist pigs we all were, it seems, back in the 90s.
Or, yeah, as Lawrence Smart asked,
what was wrong with the 90s?
What was going on in the 90s?
Yeah.
And Anita Hill and Marcia Clark. And
Monica Lewinsky.
They point out in the piece that we're at this point in time now going backwards and reevaluating those three people.
Right.
There was a documentary about Anita Hill that came out, and then Monica Lewinsky's gotten very public in the last year or two.
Might as well add Hillary.
And I wonder, I wonder if that's a helpful sort of her, Hillary's moment right now. It might be a helpful moment for all of us to use as a reason to discuss why we were so anti-women in the 90s. I mean, and were we really? But these are distinct examples of ways in which the women were just dragged through the mud and no one seemed to care.
I think we were scared of feminism to a large extent as a culture. I think that word had somehow gotten a stigma that it didn't have before, at least that stigma heightened during that period. It's funny, I don't remember, I obviously remember the O.J. trial. I don't remember all of the Marcia Clark disparagement, but as I was watching the series and watching Sarah Paulson's performance, it really nails what was going on. I didn't realize, for instance, that Judge Ito made such an ass of himself in telling her she shouldn't wear short skirts to to court and reprimanding her for profanity when he wasn't doing the same thing to Robert Shapiro.
Right.
With all kinds of double standards.
It's a thing of women who, rather than focusing on the work or the content of what they're doing, were criticizing and critiquing them based on their hairstyle and their clothing. And you're right. Hillary Clinton is the perfect example. She certainly has had plenty of commentary about her, haircuts and pantsuits and the,
And the conflation of that, of course, is that Bernie Sanders is praised for being a mess.
Right.
Which that would never be the case. Women will never get that kind of praise for not doing their hair and not caring if their clothes are wrinkled.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Dana, what do you remember about this period and about Marsha?
I remember the O.J. trial particularly well. My mom's actually a prosecutor back in Florida, and one of the first cases that she prosecuted or helped prosecute was the Danny Rollins case in Gainesville, Florida. A particularly nasty fellow who killed five co-eds. But yeah, I remember her just being completely vilified in a way that I didn't quite understand at the time since I was still fairly young. But just the way that she was treated versus the males in her same sphere and her same position was just really wrong.
We're going to listen to a little bit of the actual series People versus O.J. Simpson, and then we're going to hear Sarah Paulson talking about playing Marcia Clark.
I have left a grand jury to make this call. Where is your client?
Marcia, I'm sorry, but he's with a few doctors. He's very depressed.
Yeah, well, he should be depressed. He killed two people. He's going to prison. Now, what is your location?
I do think Marcia was vilified. She was a woman in a man's world that was not given a lot of respect, and I think predominantly actually by women. Things sort of happened where women denied that she belonged to them in a way. They didn't want to associate womanhood with that kind of woman. I don't think she got a fair shake, and I think there was so much focus on her physical appearance. Today, I sort of feel it would be a complicated sort of double-edged sword. There's even more opportunity, there's more platforms to discuss her appearance. At the same time, I think there seems to be more people rallying around the idea of reclaiming feminism, the word feminism, and what it means. I think there would be a certain embracing of her that didn't happen then.
In that New York Magazine piece, Christopher, Marcia Clark is being interviewed, and she's shocked when she hears the take that this miniseries has, that she was actually done wrong and maligned and just treated very poorly. She's like, really? They're actually looking at it differently now?
Right, because she's kind of preparing for yet another piling on moment. And some of that is Ryan Murphy. I mean, he sort of who brought us American Horror Story and Glee, and is obviously this is his baby. A lot of that is his perspective that he brings to it, I think, and his desire to make it a more sympathetic portrait of her. But it's interesting, I think, the things that balance it. Jeffrey Toobin, the book that the series is based on, made a comment recently that's quoted in the article I wanted to share. I thought it was true. Comparing the social media environment of the 90s versus now, what we were talking about earlier. And he says there was no internet, no Fox News, no MSNBC, no social media. So you had kind of a crude, broad focus without the compensations of alternative voices on Twitter and Facebook. So when the National Enquirer decided to make fun of Marcia Clark's hairdo, there was no article in Slate or Salon or post on Twitter saying, stop this sexist bullshit.
And she points out, the writer Rebecca Traister points out, that the sexist bullshit continues, but there are now other voices that can be much more readily heard,
right,
which is one of the great things. For all the things that drive me crazy about social media, that is one of the great things about social media.
Yeah, it's interesting because it is in some ways better, like undeniably better, I think, to be a woman who's at all in the public sphere. But I also think that the negativity still hurts and stings as much, no matter who's defending you. I think that she still would have received a lot of the same pushback that and that's sort of the unfortunate reality. Yeah, we've come a long way, but I don't know that it wouldn't have stung quite so much, and that she wouldn't have received criticism from more people, various ways. Yeah, hopefully she would have been defended too.
But you're right. That's true. That's a good point. The point Sarah made too, that those platforms also amplify on both sides. Yeah.
One of the things I think the miniseries really nails too is how much of a first time, one of a kind at that point media spectacle this trial was, and how all these people became celebrities all of a sudden. Marcia Clark did not sign up to be famous. She did not sign up to have her photo taken,
later photographed
on the sly
topless,
and put in National Enquirer. She did not sign up to be scrutinized in that way. And it's just so odd that Cato Kaelin, Lance Ito, Marcia Clark, Christopher Darden, Robert Shapiro, even, kind of known, but Kardashian certainly was not at that point.
Now they could be players on trading cards.
Yeah, and they're exactly, and they were put under this media microscope that I think was largely unfair, as we've been saying, more than anybody else to Marcia Clark.
And think about, after all the Making a Murderer, Serial, all the shows and things we've talked about where people obsess and follow along. Imagine having a trial like this happening now with the ability to live tweet, obsess about it, and have spinoff, having a podcast that analyzes the day's court proceedings or what have her, what a mess that would be now.
And maybe totally beneficial. I mean, maybe all of this sort of trial by social media can be beneficial in different ways. I mean, who knows what kind of evidence people could have dug up. That's what's fascinating now, is like when these things come out, when Making a Murderer and Serial sort of allow everyone access to these intimate details, they often do even more research because
when
they're
500 people show up at Brentwood and dig out clues that the police over or whatever.
You can read Rebecca Traister's article on Marcia Clark at nymag.com. The People versus O.J. Simpson airs Wednesday nights on FX. It's really, really good. We'll be right back. Last weekend at Fair Park, we had the second annual Dallas Festival of Ideas, one of the areas covered, one of the little city quadrants that became a subject was the literary city, and our own Lauren Smart was the moderator.
And our own Chris Wagner was meant to be on the
yes,
panel.
Yes, our own Chris Wagner had a stomach ailment, which had him in bed during literary city, but that's
all I can say is
here nor there.
I walked in the auditorium and I heard whispers and murmuring that Chris Wagner was not there, and I was like, "What?" And then Lauren came out, and then
so even more complicated. Yeah. Alma Gamma Prieto, who was the keynote, was trying to get on a flight to Cuba to go cover Obama's visit that morning, and she couldn't get on a flight, so she made it back just in time for the panel. But
so it's kind of like a giant cluster.
I thought, well, I'll just give a speech, I guess.
Well, you wisely brought in Will Evans to kind of help round out the panel. And actually, we should probably just say who was on the panel.
Yeah, sure. So maybe we can. Yeah. So it was a really broad mix of people there. It ended up Will Evans stepped in for Chris Wagner, and Will is the founder of Deep Ellum Publishing, a translation house in Deep Ellum, and eventually a bookstore. Daryl Dixon Carr is the chair of the English department at Southern Methodist University. Merritt Tierce is the novelist who wrote Love Me Back. She's been on our podcast. A lot of people have been on our podcast.
Will and Merritt, yeah.
And then Lisa Hembree runs Literacy, Literacy Institute for Texas. I'm close.
It's Lift.
Lift.
Yes.
And focused on promoting literacy in North Texas. And then the keynote, Alma Guillermo Prieto, is a journalist for The New Yorker and New York Times Review of Books, among other places.
And one of the great chroniclers of Latin American life.
Yeah.
Lives in Bogota now.
And I am so grateful for her and what she did on Friday night, because her keynote was so specific, because the whole idea was that they would answer questions related to the topic, and then those, and they would come up with some sort of big idea. And she strayed away from buzzwords and went straight to the gut, and she said, Dallas's problem is always going to be that it's not a walking city. Mm-hmm. All literary cities have extensive sidewalks, and they're rambling, and you become intimate with your city by walking through it. And she said, but what could be a great way to approach creating a literary city would be to create glamorous libraries in less than glamorous places. And she used an example in Colombia. In Bogota, they built three beautiful libraries and connected, and in parks, and connected them with bike paths. And
great idea,
maybe a little unrealistic for what this festival was trying to accomplish. But she had this other great idea, too, when it came to sort of how does a city start to tell its own story. She suggested a program that she's been a part of before, which was to take teenagers, high schoolers from different schools and place them with alongside journalists in neighborhoods that are unfamiliar to them. So it would be the equivalent of taking Highland Park students and sending them to Oak Cliff High Schools, and like Oak Cliff students and sending them to Lakewood, and then having them interview people in those communities and turning those into stories. And it accomplishes a lot of things. One, it encourages the appreciation for storytelling at a young age, mm-hmm. but it also rounds out perspectives on the city that you live in. And then that could be published somewhere, or you could win prizes for it. And I just love that idea.
I thought it was interesting because you had shared that you had tried that in the journalism class you were teaching at SMU, trying to get those students out of the class, out of the park cities, and out into the city.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's so important.
Yeah, and I think that a lot of times one of Dallas's biggest flaws, just generally, not necessarily even in terms of literary life, is that we are creatures of habit, and we stay in our neighborhoods, and we get in our cars and we drive home, and maybe we go out to the grocery store, or you stay in your space, and your space is filled with other people who look like you.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I'm generally not going to go north of 635.
I don't know if I would. I would slap you on the
Chris.
Wrist for that necessarily.
So I'd like to play devil's advocate just a little bit on the walking city, driving city thing, because I think Los Angeles has been a great literary city. It has a very rich tradition, especially in crime fiction and noir. So they have something there that...
Better weather?
Maybe. A little more seediness, perhaps.
Right.
There's something, I guess they have the mystique that Dallas perhaps... does not. So I get what she's saying, but that was just the first thing that popped into my head, is that a lot of great writing has been set there.
It's a really good point. And the other point that I would add to that is, because the sidewalks thing came up in almost every panel this weekend.
Interesting.
That was kind of a running theme, right?
Yeah.
Which is great, because this is not a very pedestrian-friendly city.
It came up
in
the healthy city, in terms of, like, if you want a healthy city, people should be encouraged to walk places and not drive half a mile. It came up in the physical city in terms of creating a space that people want to be in. And then obviously it came up in the way that I just said. But for me, I guess I'm less focused on, when it comes to creating a literary city, I'm less focused on this idea that things need to be changed about the physical city, so much as it would be interesting to reflect on what it is that does exist here. Mm-hmm. If we are all isolated in our pockets, it does make sense to send especially young people into different communities and see what comes of that.
When I interviewed Alma Guillermo Prieto when I was healthy before the festival, I guess, she even offered that New York, that Manhattan is no longer a good writer city because writers can't afford to live there.
Yeah.
And all of its, not all of its, but much of its funkiness has been replaced by chain stores.
Well, and interestingly, earlier in the day, Suzanne Frank spoke in conversation with David Hale Smith, and she said Dallas is a literary city. We're not giving it enough credit. And that part of the things that she's noticed is that there aren't enough writing clubs and there aren't enough book clubs and there aren't enough people meeting in coffee shops to discuss and participate mm-hmm. in reading and writing and what that looks like. And then someone asked that question on the panel. They said, well, how do we make reading sexy again?
I love that with Will Evans.
Will Evans got pissed because he said it is still sexy. It's so sexy. But I think
with his Russian novelist tattoos right. on his body.
But I think that there's something about that that is true. And you said this, Chris, in the original planning meeting, that we have two stigmas when it comes to reading. One is reading in general. And then two is there's like the hierarchy of if you read, you better read good books. Don't read Twilight kind
right.
of thing.
Yeah, there's the reading is for suckers, which I think is more predominant among youth now. And then there's the why are you reading that trash thing.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, you should just read.
Yeah.
Damn it.
And an interesting sidebar discussion that came up on that panel too was, digital reading books versus, print versus digital and all of that. And reading on your phone, I loved the comment Merritt Tierce read about if you can walk down the street reading your phone, you can also walk down the street and read a book.
Yeah.
It's a good point.
It's
you can't listen
point.
To music from your book, though.
That's true.
The crucial difference.
That's a good point.
For more information or to get involved, you'll find links and resources at thedallasfestival.com. We will be right back with Touts. Let's move on to our touts. This is the portion of our show where each of us recommends one thing we are reading, watching, clicking on, listening to, or just plain obsessed with. Lauren Smart, what are you reading, watching, clicking on, listening to, or just plain obsessed
none
with?
None of those things. Well, I'm going to say something that may be hyperbolic, but I think two of the very best acting performances we will see on Dallas stages this year are happening right now. Barry Nash is a vitriolic playwright father in I'm Gonna Pray for You So Hard, which Kitchen Dog Theater is doing at the Green Zone.
Is that on now?
It's mm-hmm. through March
12th.
And great
title.
It is so good.
He's a really good actor.
He's amazing.
He's a really, really nice dude, too.
He is all of those things. And it's revelatory. His performance is amazing in this. And Jenny Liddell is great, too. But he will blow you away. And then at Undermain Theater, Joanna Schellenberg is playing Mary Tyrone in Long Day's Journey and Tonight.
Another thing I missed with my stomach virus.
I feel bad for you because that's going to sell out real fast. And she's really, really, really spectacular. It's such a hard part for anyone to play. And I swear, I don't know how she does it, but she gets more brittle and fragile in every scene of the play, and that's exactly what that character should do. It's amazing.
Such a brutal I haven't seen this production. Such a brutal play, though.
Oh my god, yeah. It's 3 hours. I left shaken up, and I was supposed to meet friends for drinks, and I couldn't leave my house. I thought you were gonna say
I never wanted to drink again.
Well, that too. That's both of these plays are about addiction and specifically alcoholism, and they both leave you thinking, one, I never want to drink again, but two, God, I really need a drink right now. And I think Long Day's Journey is playing through March 5th or 6th. So
cool. C-Dub.
I've been getting very BBC lately and binge watching a 5-part series called it's BBC Two, by the way, which is their more upscale channel even. But actually, it's on BBC America right now is how I saw it. It's called London Spy. And it has Ben Whishaw, who most of you will know more as Q, the new Q in the James Bond films, Skyfall and Spectre. So he's kind of the little emo, moppy-haired Q. in London Spy, he looks pretty much the same. But the twist that I think is interesting is that he plays a gay character. So he's a young man who meets a mysterious, handsome guy, and they have this weird, intense love and romance connection, and then the other guy disappears under very weird, odd circumstances. And the rest of the series is Ben's character being thrust into this underworld of spies and spy games and intrigue. But what's interesting about it is it's not really about that. At the end, it's about their love and their romance and their connection. You know, was it real? Was it not? Was it part of a spy game, or was this a sincere thing? And so the emotions and the feelings actually drive the series. Hmm. And it's really compelling, really high production values. So I recommend it. It's called London Spy.
You know what he's great in is he plays John Keats in a film called Bright Star.
Mm-hmm.
It's fantastic.
I haven't seen that, but I will.
I'm a big Keats fan.
And there's lots of, you know, staring into Ben's eyes and face. You know, it's a very slow-paced series, so be prepared. But
I can bust out a little Ode to a Mockingbird.
Yeah. Please.
For beauty is truth, and truth is beauty.
Oh.
That's all I got.
Don't stop.
No, I will, actually. What am I touting? Oh, yes. So I've done a sort of deep dive into the world of Mike Nichols of late. There's a whole bunch of stuff going on. This Friday, HBO has a documentary, premiering a documentary called Becoming Mike Nichols, which is about his early career up through The Graduate, which came out in 1967. American Masters just had its own Mike Nichols documentary a couple weeks ago that was actually directed by Elaine May, his amazing improv partner from the very beginning of his career. And then Criterion, the Criterion Collection, just released The Graduate on Blu-ray.
Really?
This week. So, and then
I love a good Criterion DVD with all the extra stuff jammed in there, and the books and all that.
So then, of course, I had to watch Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf again.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's a happy movie.
With our theme.
For the first two films of your career, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf and The Graduate, you're setting to such a high, high bar for yourself. He's a fascinating guy. His parents were both European immigrants. They got out just ahead of the Nazi reign. And he was, you know, kind of a bookish outsider. And he was just prodigiously smart and funny. And did a lot of great work. Even after that meteoric start, continued to do real solid work over the years.
I always loved, too, the way he used music in his films, the way he would take a theme or a song and bring it back and back, and that became a theme, you know, a motif. It just, Mike Nichols is amazing.
It's funny, he talks about how he had gotten the first Simon and Garfunkel album from his brother, and he couldn't stop listening to it. And,
really? Is that how that kind of came about, The Graduate?
And he was working on The Graduate at that time, and it suddenly hit him. He's like, I have to use this for The Graduate.
I mean, can you imagine that movie without those songs now? To me, you can't. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And last little funny bit of kind of weirdness, Mrs. Robinson, the only part of that song that was ready for and is in The Graduate is the chorus.
Oh, really?
The rest of it is dee 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 because Simon had not written the lyrics yet.
Oh, how funny!
So he wrote them afterwards.
That's funny. Yeah, interesting.
Yeah. Dana, what would you like to tout?
I've actually got something that's a little bit of an oldie but a goodie. A story I've been keeping up with. It's about a girl who started it's a hashtag called 1000 Black Girl Books.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and it sort of combines two of our segments with diversity and the literary city.
Well done.
Yeah. But no, I'm really fascinated by this girl who decided she was tired of reading about what she said in school was nothing but boys and their dogs. And decided to hold a book drive to gather nothing but books about that had black female protagonist, and to donate those books to kids who either didn't have access to books or who might not have access to books about people who look like them.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm really in love.
That. What a great idea!
Yeah, I'm really in love with a lot of the stories in the news right now about kids getting up and making a difference.
Yeah.
And what's the name of the site, the account again?
Hashtag
1000 Black Girl Books.
And you can find it on Twitter?
Yes.
Okay. Sounds really cool. You'll find links to some of the things we've talked about today on our show page at guidelive.com/podcasts. Drop us an email at mixedmedia@dallasnews.com or send us a tweet at mixedmediapod. Please subscribe to our show in iTunes and leave us a review. Only if it's a good one. Just search for our name. Mixed Media is engineered by Brian Elledge. Actually, today it was introduced, it was engineered by the great Tommy Noel.
All right, Tommy.
Tommy, sitting in for Brian Elledge. And produced by Christopher Wynn and Chris Wagner. We'll be back in 2 weeks, hopefully, with the new episode. Until then, for Christopher Wynn, Lauren Smart, Dana Amahir, I'm Chris Wagner, and we thank you for joining us.